Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David B. Overson presiding, is now in session.
Please be seated. Good morning. The first matter for court's consideration this morning is in the matter of Scott Swear, attorney at law for the Disciplinary Board of the State of South Dakota. We have Mr. Robert Freeburg and Mr. Thomas Freeburg. And I understand this morning Mr. Robert Freeburg will be presenting, correct?
Correct, Your
Honor. All right. And then for Mr. Swear, we have Mr. Jeffrey Hurd, an attorney from Rapid City. These proceedings are a little bit unique, and this is the only proceeding I'm aware of where we allow the client to directly address the court. That's at their option. So you can, if that's going to be done, handle your 20 minutes accordingly. Any questions on that? Okay. All right. And it's a different bench this morning. Justice Kern and Justice Devaney have disqualified themselves. The court has appointed the Honorable Susan Sabers, a judge from the Second Judicial Circuit, to sit in place of Justice Kern, and the Honorable Carmen Means, a circuit judge from the Third Circuit, to sit in place of Justice Devaney. We actually have five justices participating this morning, but unfortunately, Justice Salter injured his ankle, and he's not terribly mobile right now. He's on the phone line. Justice Salter, are you with us?
I can hear you perfectly. Thank you.
Okay,
good morning.
Thank you, Justice. With that, Mr. Freeburg, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, I'm Bob Freeburg, counsel for the Disciplinary Board, and like today for you, this might be my valedictory also.
Well, you're not getting rid of me quite that quick. I'll be around till the end of the year.
Right, but you're making your valedictory today, I understand.
Right, and I suspect you'll be around longer than the end of the year. Go ahead.
Good Lord willing, I will be, thank you. My remarks will, I think, be brief. This was a somewhat unusual case for the disciplinary board and somewhat difficult in the sense that there were a lot of moving parts as the board got into its investigation of the two complaints that came to the board, the one from Mr. Thieler and the one from Mr. Jill Samino. The recommendation which came to the court and which we subsequently amended to clarify and at the request of Mr. Swear was a product of a careful consideration by the board. And the board has always been governed and directed by the literature governing lawyer conduct and by the decisions of this court over a long period of time, that the first obligation of the board is the protection of the public. The second is to sanction attorneys, and that includes sending a message to the rest of the bar about the necessity to obey the rules governing an attorney's conduct. And of course, the third is to preserve respect for the administration of justice. When this was all said and done, after a series of hearings, as you well know, the board determined that given the change in attitude that the board perceived from Mr. Swear as we went through these various hearings, and as we perceived his acknowledgement that his supervision of the attorneys who were working for the Swear Law Firm was lacking, and as he addressed us at some length as his efforts to change the way he was doing that and to You know, we had an interim of 2 or 3 months between these hearings, and from the first to the second with him, he explained to us the things he was doing to change the way he maintained supervision over the people, the lawyers who were working in his firm. And so I think that helped the board lean toward an understanding that part of its function was also to be satisfied that the problem which brought this complaint was being resolved. I think the two things that the board was most concerned about, and which eventually Mr. Swear acknowledged he had faulted, was the lack of response to Mr. Thieler when Mr. Thieler first became involved in the Hickey matter and proceeding to enter a ex parte proceeding, appoint a guardian, conservator, and so on and so on. And before our investigation was completed, he acknowledged that that was a mistake that he should have caught. And so I think the board gave some credence and some credibility to
that. If I remember right, though, he never voluntarily recused himself. He was ordered off by a circuit judge, wasn't he?
That's correct, Your Honor. But I think he, in his testimony before the board, I think he did say that he recognized that he was wrong.
Okay.
And I think the board took that to be an honest response from him, that he acknowledged that he had not done that properly. With respect to the second complaint from Mr. Gelsomino, at the conclusion of the hearing, Mr. Swear agreed that he ought to refund the retainer that had been paid to his firm. Initially, he felt that they had, that the firm had earned the retainer. But for whatever reason, and perhaps advice of his counsel, he recognized that that was a mistake. And at the conclusion of our last hearing, he indicated that he would repay that $3,700 to the client because I think because he realized the board thought that was improper. But at least, again, he acknowledged the error of his ways, and I think that's why the board came with a recommendation that it did.
Was there any discussion at any point about $144,000 in fees on the probate case, and you know that a lot of those fees were charged on the litigation, and then there was research on the conflict and addressing that, and you know, was there any discussion about disgorging any of those or anything like that?
There was not, but the board was aware that there was a civil action pending, which was addressing that issue. And the board's always taken the view that it has no authority to order disgorgement or to refund, but it does recognize that it has a certain amount of leverage to achieve that result if people agree to do it.
So you take the position, or the board does, they do not have legal authority to order restitution?
That's correct.
Okay.
What do you know what the outcome of that civil?
I do not.
Maybe Mr. Hurd will enlighten us.
Yeah,
I don't know what that is. Perhaps Mr. Swear or Mr. Hurd will be able to tell you, Justice Jensen. That's the extent of my remarks.
I have a couple other questions. Now, the findings that were filed by the board, were they unanimous?
Yes.
Okay. Was the recommendation unanimous?
Yes.
Okay.
Our practice when we did this was we draft these based on what we have seen and heard at the hearing, circulate them all to the board before they're put in final form and served and filed with the court. So all of the board had a chance to critique and approve the findings as and the amendment that were submitted to and filed with the court.
Okay, any other questions for counsel from the bench? If not...
I do have one follow-up question. So when the board's deciding on discipline, you make your findings and found ethical violations, and then you decide on discipline. Obviously, the rule is pretty broad and pretty wide open. Does the board look at other cases? Are there specific considerations you make in terms of your ultimate recommendation? Obviously, it's a recommendation to us, but how do you reach that recommendation at the board level?
Well, I think the board historically has relied somewhat on counsel to have done that and to provide some guidance to the members of the board as to the decisions of this court and to the annotations to the model rules. So, yes, we do pay attention. I think the members of the board are pretty familiar with the annotations to the model rules. And sometimes, if I see a case that I think is particularly apropos for what we're considering, I'll either make copies and send it to them or give them the citation and ask them to look at those cases. So, yes, we do.
Do you, I know you've been around a long time in this type of a practice. Do you see any of our previous cases similar to this one?
Probably some elements, but I think not. Certainly not on all fours with this.
Okay.
No, I think we've had cases with, questions about the amount of fees. We've dealt with those. We've had questions about how you treat your adversaries, and questions about, the struggle to do how you do with someone you think's incompetent or lacking competency to do something. We've had cases that deal with all of those issues over the years, but I don't think any that ever had quite all of these same kinds of issues all together in one or two proceedings, however you look at the total package here.
So you would see this basically as a case of first impression.
That's true, and that's certainly true in terms of the recommendation we made.
Okay. Any other questions from the bench for Mr. Freeburg? If not, thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Hurd.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, counsel. I'm Jeff Hurd. I'm from Rapid City. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Swear. As Mr. Freeburg explained, we're here essentially on disciplinary action that arises out of two conflicts of interest. In one of those cases, no conflicts check was done. Systemically, they just blew it, and my client has admitted that. In another one of them, there was an initial conflicts analysis done, which allowed them to proceed in their belief under Rule 1.14. The case shifted, and they never reanalyzed whether that change in the case now put them in a conflicted situation. So beginning with the question, Mr. Chief Justice, of why, when the email came from Thieler saying, I think you have a conflict and you're going to need to get off, why didn't they analyze it at that time and leave? Then when the motion to disqualify was made, why didn't they just say, yeah, we have to get off in that time and leave? This is a situation of one of those taking one step at a time until you walk yourself off the cliff. This isn't in the findings. It doesn't change the fact that there was a conflict. But when Judge Zell, at the hearing to determine whether or not the guardianship and conservatorship would be extended, when he found that it would not be extended and he found the client competent, at that hearing, he made the comment that he was denying a motion to replace the co-trustee and said that that would need to be addressed separately. Coming out of that hearing, Mr. Thieler contacted the Swear firm to discuss a mediation to deal with that issue. Swear law firm responded that it would like to use the ADR proceedings that were in the trust. If the ADR proceedings, which simply appoint a third co-trustee, lawyers aren't involved at all. So at that point, you have a conflict, right? I mean, if you proceed under 1.14, fine. Once the judge says, I find the client competent, now the client gets to decide what happens. You can no longer think you're acting in the best interest of the client. Once the circuit court held, the client's competent to decide what's in her own best interests. Having done that, they believed that if they could invoke the ADR proceeding, they'd essentially be out at that point. No more adversarial process. Then they were invited to conduct a mediation. Again, they're thinking, we're going to get out of this. No need to bring somebody in, start them from fresh. We can just get this resolved and get out of it. Well, that didn't happen. The deck action got filed because, not on good information.
Okay, that's good, that step.
Yes.
Hindsight?
Well, there's clearly a conflict.
Yeah.
And they've acknowledged that. As soon as Judge Zell ruled. I'm sorry?
Mr. Swear acknowledges that?
He does. Okay. He does. Everyone who is involved in that case, as soon as Judge Zell says, Shirley is competent to make her own decisions, now your only hook is for the no conflict. Rule 1.14 doesn't apply.
So at the time Judge Zell says, Shirley, you're competent, who's her attorney?
Jack Thieler.
Okay.
But he was her attorney. The court had approved Thieler representing Shirley in the guardianship and conservatorship process. So maybe a better way to say it is, while everybody thought they were working in Shirley's best interests, once Judge Zell said Shirley gets to decide what's in Shirley's best interests, then Thieler was the only one at that point who could claim to be her lawyer.
Okay.
So Mr. Hurd, if I could, excuse me.
Justice Sullivan.
Mr. Hurd, so then who is Mr. Swear's client when he was pursuing the ADR option?
That would have been their belief was they were acting on behalf of the trust for Shirley's benefit, which would make the co-trustee the person who was giving them instructions. I think one of the problems here is that they got muddied up on the idea that they were trying to protect Shirley, which created kind of a moving idea as to who the client was. But if the trust is the client and they are taking directions from the co-trustee, I think technically the co-trustee would be the client, like a PR of an estate, but it is for the best interests of Shirley Hickey.
But of course, the co-trustee was discharged right after the proceeding in front of Judge Zell.
Yes, the co-trustee was discharged. Well, there was a filing to remove and replace the co-trustee. The ADR proceeding and the subsequent motion for summary judgment were questioning whether Shirley had authority to do that under the trust document. The question of the fees that were incurred, that's the subject of a current civil lawsuit. Right now, we're in the middle of discovery, so that is yet to be resolved, but that is an ongoing proceeding.
Is that Shirley is the plaintiff and Mr. Swear is the defendant?
The estate of Shirley Hickey, Mrs. Hickey has died.
Oh, that's right.
So the estate of Shirley Hickey and her revocable trust are the plaintiffs. The defendants are the Swear firm and the original co-trustee.
Does that also include the fees charged by Mr. Thieler to Shirley?
It is. They have claimed the trust, the fees incurred by the trust, the fees incurred by Shirley herself, and a claim to get back the fees that were paid to the SWIR law.
What about the fees that were paid to the attorney appointed by the court as a kind of an investigator?
Yes, those are also included in the claim. Essentially, the damages that are sought under the complaint in that case are all of the money that was expended from essentially August 21st of 2017 until the case was
realizing resolved. The plaintiff has to establish that. What's the amount they're seeking?
Right now, if I they haven't given me a complete number. I'm also defending that case.
All right.
They haven't given me a complete number, but you're going to be looking at something scary in $400,000.
All right. Thank you.
So what's your defense? So what's the defense in that case?
There's a causation defense. The co-trustee has indicated that she would have pursued this action through another lawyer. So if the SWIR law firm had indicated that it had a conflict and she needed to get somebody else to pursue these actions, she still would have done it. There is also a question as to which fees were conflicted and which fees were not conflicted. And then there's a fairly substantial accounting issue because many of these fees were incurred carrying out the instructions of Shirley Hickey prior to all of this arising. The Hickey estate was valued at about $10 million at one point, and so they're trying to get as much of her assets into the trust as they can, including LLC interests, other trusts, some revocable, some not revocable, and corporate interests. So a chunk of those fees were incurred trying to bind up all of her assets and get them into the revocable trust.
So a follow-up on that, notwithstanding the civil action, do you have a position, I don't know if you've researched it or looked at it, on whether you think this court has authority to either order disgorgement or restitution? Obviously, they're spending attorney's fees to litigate this civil case. Do you have any view on that?
In 1619, the only authority that is given are those to seek statutory costs, the costs of these proceedings and those kinds of things. It would not, at least there's nothing that I see in the statutes that specifically address that. There's, 1619-10 or one of the early ones that essentially says this court has the inherent power to regulate the conditions under which attorneys practice in the state of South Dakota. So I suppose there's that hook out there.
You see us as the 800-pound gorilla.
I definitely do. As we began this, we actually asked the disciplinary board. The board has the authority to stay disciplinary proceedings during the pendency of civil actions. We originally sought to do that because, of course, in a civil action, I can put you to your proof. It is really bad strategy, if not completely improper, for a lawyer to come before the disciplinary board and say, I don't want to participate at all. You're going to have to subpoena me and you're going to have to prove up your case. So the two, there's a competition between these two pending things. The same lawyer who represents the plaintiff in the civil case brought the complaint and is receiving all of the responses we make. So as we come before the board functionally to confess our sins, we're confessing to the lawyer that has us by the throat in the civil proceeding at the same time. That creates no small amount of tension, but the board, it's in its discretion, and the board chose not to exercise its discretion to stay the disciplinary proceedings.
Did you seek that?
We did. Yeah, we did initially. But again, that's wholly discretionary on the board's part.
Yeah.
This is a unique case. I believe the second complaint came in the day after Mr. Swear appeared before the disciplinary board the first time on the first case. So we're looking at two conflicts issues that failed. They failed for completely different reasons. But he has subsequently made changes to the way he checks conflicts. He has subsequently changed the way that he handles all of these reviews. The firm is now doing things better. We have been asked to do something never before asked. That is a public censure that we post on our website. I you know, I asked him whether or not he wanted to try to challenge that, whether there are constitutional issues with compelled speech in that frame. And he simply, look, he acknowledges this is his problem. He made this problem. He's got to fix it. And he's willing to abide by the recommendations of the disciplinary board.
Has the money been paid back on the second case?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yes, it has. Right. Should have said that earlier. And unless there are further questions, I will allow Mr. Swear to answer any questions you might have for him.
Okay. Any questions from the bench for counsel? If not, thank you, counsel. Mr.
Thank you.
Swear.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I just have a couple things. I've been practicing for 20 years, and the two most important things in my life are my ability to have a family and to be a really good lawyer. And for 20 years, I think I have been exceptional in both of those type of situations. Every day, I strive to do the right thing. Before these two incidents came up, I had never had even an inkling of a complaint in 20 years of practicing. What happened here is, in a very short period of time, we started a law firm that grew immensely, very quickly. And we had a lot of very good lawyers, and we have a lot of good lawyers. What happened in these two cases, I took full responsibility for as the senior partner of the firm. The Hickey case, the declaratory judgment at the end of the case, my attorney should not have filed that case, and I should have caught that, and that's my fault. The Gelissimo case, there were thousands of pages of documents that I had my associate review. There was an email that came in early with all the documents. I gave that to my associate. I missed the email that referred to a past client of mine. Those were my two mistakes. Our conflict system has been redone so that we don't have these problems again. It's something that I worked on all summer so that, again, we could make sure that this does not happen again. We'd never had it happen before in 10 years. We just had these two things come up. I am incredibly sorry that this happened. I cannot take this more seriously than what I did. And we think that we've done everything possible to make sure that we have the procedures in place. But again, and I've been in front of some of you as circuit court judges, our firm does a very good job. We have good lawyers. I take full responsibility for what happened here, and I'm sorry that it happened. And again, we've done everything to remedy that it doesn't again. We do very good work for people. We have very good attorneys. But I think taking responsibility is something that this court has always looked at, and we have. And I would be happy to answer any questions you may have, but I do want you to realize how seriously we are taking these systemic changes and have made those changes so it doesn't happen again.
Any questions for Mr. Swear from the bench?
Can you tell me specifically how have you changed your conflict system?
Sure.
What are you doing right now?
And what I can do, Justice Jensen, is tell you what it was when this happened and how it is before. What we did before is we have a central database system that would contain all the former clients and everything that we would have. All right? What happens then is originally when a new client would come in, the new client's name, the opposing party, any of the other parties, that would be emailed to me as the senior partner. We would then take that information. We would send out a firm-wide email. At the time, we had probably 20-some attorneys and employees. We would go ahead and we would send all that out. We would make sure that the database didn't come up with anything. And that was what the conflict system was. And we never had any trouble with that. Now, systemically, with the Hickey case, we knew who the players were. So the systemic part of it didn't fail. It was just that we should not have filed the declaratory judgment action toward the end of the case. Now what we've done is we've taken that system and put another layer or two on it, which we're still doing it the same way through a central database analysis, also an email. Our attorneys now have to do a better job of making sure that not only do we know the primary parties, the plaintiff and the defendant. But we also need to make sure that as we go through the case and learn more about players, that information also has to be provided to management so that we can make sure that we have those new players in the case gone through the conflict check, gone through the central database, so we don't have it happen where we know the plaintiff and defendant, but we also need to do a better job of knowing the ancillary parties. So we have really taken what we thought was a structure that had worked for 10 years, and then after this proceeding began, we took it to a next level where our attorneys are now have to be hyper-vigilant about making sure that these conflict situations don't arise. So we have both a manual system, we also have a central database system to make sure that indeed, if a conflict does arise, we catch it at the very beginning.
Justice Salter, are you trying to get a question in?
I was, I'm sorry. Forgive me for interrupting. Mr. Swear, how many lawyers do you have currently in your firm, and where are they located?
Yep. At the time this started, we had 11 through 5 offices throughout the state. Now we have 6 attorneys through 3 offices in the state.
And do you still have an association with the lawyer in Minneapolis and the one in Germany?
Yeah, the lawyer in Minneapolis just does a specialty for us. And the estate planning lawyer who's in Germany with her military husband, she still works with us also.
Are those attorneys supervised and do they have access to participate in the conflict check that you just described as if they were here in South Dakota?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just in terms of years, and I won't hold you to a specific number, but maybe just round number here, what's the average experience level for those attorneys that are working?
The ones that we have now, we would have myself with 22 years. We'd have one of our others with 22 years of experience. We would have another attorney that would have now her 10th year of experience, Ms. Skraka, I believe, has been an attorney for 15 years, and our other attorney would have 4 years of experience. So, and just to give you an idea, Judge Justice Salter, our estate planning attorney, who's originally from Minnesota, again, is in the military with her husband, she's the only attorney in South Dakota who has her LLM degree in estate planning from the Heckerling Institute at the University of Miami, which is the premier estate planning LLM program in the country. Our attorneys have clerked for state and federal judges. We've represented everyone from the governor on down. So when you talk about the experience of our attorneys, we have a very good experienced group of attorneys.
Thank you.
Are the attorneys from Minneapolis and Germany licensed to practice in South Dakota?
Absolutely.
Right. Any other questions for Mr. Swear from the bench? Anything, closing comments from you, counsel?
No, Your Honor. Again, thank you for the opportunity. And again, we take this incredibly, incredibly seriously.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Swear.
Thank you.
Mr. Freeberg, sir, you have 10 minutes for reply.
I don't think there's anything more that I have to offer based on what the respondents have had to say here. So unless there are other questions to the board or me, no.
Any questions for Counsel Freeberg from the D board?
I have one, Chief, if I could, please.
Sure.
Good morning, Mr. Freeberg. And my impression was as I read the board's findings and conclusions, and I read the transcripts in both of these matters as well, but my impression was that the board felt as though, as you say, Mr. Swear came to a point of acknowledgement and acceptance at some point, but it seemed like the board felt that that was slow in coming. Am I right? And if so, did that temper somehow how they perceived his acceptance of responsibility?
Yes, Justice Alter, I think the board did think that the acknowledgement was slow in coming. My own personal perception is that the two triggers, if you will, are the two things that the board found most disconcerting were the, as I said in my earlier statement, were the lack of response and refusal to respond to Mr. Seeler. And secondly, the matter of the conflict that developed with the real estate matter. I think those were the two things, and I think the board was satisfied at the conclusion of its investigation that Mr. Swear had acknowledged that, had taken steps to avoid a repeat of that kind of situation to occur again. And that's what he has represented here today. And so from that perspective, I think the board has done good work.
Any other questions for Mr. Freeburg from the bench? There being none, thank you, counsel.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And the court will be in recess.